Hi, this is Vipul Singh. Today, I'm going to explain you the concept of ecological imperialism. We will see how it is associated with the activities of humans introducing non-native species into new environments. I'll also explain to you the very introduction of eucalyptus plants in India and various South Asian regions. We have earlier discussed in the class the whole concept of Columbian exchange. Now, another book that Alfred Crosby wrote is basically an extension of his hypothesis of what we understood as Columbian exchange. And I told you in that story that, you know, his book, which was titled as Columbian Exchange itself, you know, he confines his analysis to the implication of Christopher Columbus' discovery in America. So he talks about its implication both in the newer world and in the older world. So in terms of, you know, for example, its implication in the new world, he talks about a lot of mortalities due to disease. And then in the same vein, he also talks about the travel of disease like syphilis to Europe. Now, the Columbian exchange and ecological imperialism in that sense are two very interconnected historical phenomena. And they, in fact, while, you know, you've seen in the case of Columbian exchange that it refers to, you know, kind of a variety of transfer of plants. We talked about different plants which were transferred from one region to the other. Animal transfer, disease transfer, you know, transfer also in terms of cultural practices. So there were transfers between the two worlds, the old world and new world. So geographers often divided the earth into two hemisphere called northern and southern hemisphere. But for us as history scholars, basically we see this entire earth as western and eastern hemisphere. So you have, you know, people, you know, getting connected to the new world, what we may call as western hemisphere. So it all happened after Christopher Columbus discovered Americas in 1492. So, you know, this we discussed that how it was a transformative period of global exchange, which, you know, resulted in some kind of circulation of different products, different commodities. So it all started from Europe, you know, Europe. There were a few products which also got transferred from Africa. In fact, in terms of human labor, much of the transfer was from Africa, because when there were huge mortality in the Americas due to the disease transfer from Europe, then the Europeans had set up many plantations there. They were not finding enough people to work on these plantations, so they carried people from Africa. So the most, in fact, I would say the notable aspect of Columbian exchange was, of course, the transfer of biological, you know, organisms. But you know, the human labor transfer was also one of the most important aspects of Columbian exchange. Right. Now, this you know, this hypothesis, what we call as ecological imperialism, which is the main theme of discussion today. It was again a term which was coined by Alfred Crosby, and in fact he titled his book as Ecological Imperialism. And in fact the entire book, as you can see on your screen, Ecological Imperialism: The Biological Expansion of Europe from 900 to 1900. So instead of talking about, because in Colombian exchange you've seen that the entire story revolves around Columbus' discovery of America and post-Columbian period. But here in this book, he begins his story from 900 onwards. His book actually describes how European powers, especially, these European powers like Spain, England, even Portugal, France, these European countries, they imposed their own economic and agricultural systems. And they had actually gone to newer regions of the world. These had often had in an influence and a kind of an impact on those newer local ecosystems. So these new knowledge of the Europeans, which has gone to the newer regions, often went there at the expense of the local ecosystems. So, many of these regions had indigenous populations. So they were all affected by that. So the arrival of different European, Europeans and the European colonizers, we have seen in the case of Colombian exchange that it had led to significant ecological changes. Now, on similar line, he explains that how in other parts of the world, it also had almost, not very similar, but, in terms of implication, similar ecological changes. So, they introduced new agricultural practices. They introduced, sometimes, as we have seen in the case of Colombian exchange, these were unintentional also. So he talks about these unintentional transfers also, but in case of the countries like India, although Alfred Crosby doesn't talk about eucalyptus as such, but I have tried to bring in the discussion on eucalyptus because these are certain plants which were in some way deliberately brought. So these were not unintentional transfers. The major emphasis of Alfred Crosby's ecological imperialism is the unintentional transfers. Even in the Colombian exchanges, major emphasis is the unintentional transfer. Right? So, overall, what we have seen that the ecological imperialism is kind of a concept that describes the phenomena of one species or plant from one ecosystem getting transferred to a newer ecosystem, and it often results in sometimes displacement, sometimes complete elimination of the native species. So I mean, in terms of disease, if you see, there is obviously mortality. But in, you know, there are in cases like for example, in plants, you would see that, you know, there is initially a gradual displacement and then complete elimination of the local species. So if you read Ecological Imperialism, I will be sharing the book with you later on. So if you read that, it had, you know, it had several mechanisms within the ecological imperialisms. Like, it talks about the biological implications, the disease transmissions, right? It talks about even the habitat modifications, how, you know, non-native go there and they change, and the physical environment also. They disrupt the ecosystem there also. So ecological imperialism discusses different consequences, as it was explained also in Columbian exchange hypothesis. Now, Alfred Crosby, when he was writing this book, this was almost a decade later, more than a decade later, when he wrote his first book, The Columbian Exchange. And obviously, you know, he has tried to consolidate his earlier hypothesis of Columbian Exchange here. But because it, you know, if you, you must have observed that in the case of Columbian Exchange, his major thrust is on, you know, the biological exchanges and the ecological consequences. Now, the book actually begins with a very interesting anecdote. And in fact, I mentioned that earlier in the class, when, you know, when I said that, you know, an idea came to his mind that why European immigrants or their presence of not only the immigrants but also their descendants is all around the globe. So he refers to all these European immigrants and their descendants as Neo-Europes, right? So these Neo-Europes are characterized by, according to him, it is, and he actually characterizes them as people who had some kind of European connections. They are either descendants of the Europeans who were living for centuries in Europe and who had migrated to the different newer regions. So Crosby's narrative actually revolves around this, the concept that the success of Europe in capturing, or maybe we can say invading, you know, and or conquering and then, you know, settling there in many large parts of non-European world. Now, according to him, it was not simply a matter of coincidence. So it's not a coincidence that all these Europeans or their descendants are found all around the globe. Rather, he says that it was heavily because of the fact, because, I mean, there were simultaneous invasions or, you know, attempts by the Europeans through their, what he uses a term called the biological allies, right? So, for terms like, I mean, for things like weeds, even diseases, animals, different plants. So, he calls them as biological allies. So, he says that these were Europe's biological allies. And in, you know, through the use of these, you know, biological allies, Crosby says that Europe actually was successful, or the Europeans were successful in settling there and conquering those land because of this, you know, these allies who went with them. So rather than discovering and settling the new worlds on foreign shores, Europeans had basically, you know, come up with they understood the old world flora and fauna, and then tried to manipulate that. So it's not that when they come here, they just bring in all those flora and fauna. There was a major survey. If you read the different surveys of, for example, of late 18th or maybe early 19th century, like, for example, Francis Buchanan is a famous, you know, surveyor. He has written a lot on different regions of India. So the British East India Company had hired Francis Buchanan to do surveys of different regions. So it's not that they did it just like anything. I mean, they just brought the plants and brought the animals and then displaced the older ones and created a new one. There were surveys. They realized that what are the kind of plants that could be successful in particular regions, and then they brought here and then effectively transformed the landscapes. So basically, Alfred Crosby contextualizes his analysis within, you know, or, you know, all his details that he brings in with a some kind of a very broad framework of biology, the plants, animals, right? And he uses especially the countries like Australia and New Zealand for his analysis, but he has not, I mean, he also uses a few countries like of Africa. In the case of India, he has been he's been almost silent. But as, you know, as the environmental history progressed, as I said that, you know, environmental history as a discipline was just emerging in the 1970s. And this book was written somewhere around 1986 or 1987, something like that. So when this book was written, this, you know, people from India, people working on the sources of Indian subcontinent, they were influenced by these ideas. And I think there are many historians, there are many environmental historians who are working on these ideas of the influence of disease. Like David Arnold is one of them, although his context is completely different from what Alfred Crosby talks about. But there are historians who have been working on this idea of impact of the European concept of disease, or maybe sometimes medicines, or, you know, the transfer of plants and animals. So one of the important aspects that I am planning to discuss with you today is the, when we have seen that what ecological imperialism is, eucalyptus is one plant that is, you know, quite well known today in India. But this plant was not actually known to the Indians earlier. Now, as we know that the hypothesis of ecological imperialism refers to the spread of non-native species, which were often facilitated by, you know, European activities in the newer world. Not exactly newer world, but in the newer regions. So there, you know, how these people from Europe, they, and, you know, sometimes from the mainland, they brought different plants, animals, and subsequently dominated and displaced the native species. Now, another case study that I would be discussing later on in this lecture would be, you know, the case of Andaman Island, where you would see that it's not the some kind of a plant which has been brought from outside, or Europeans for that matter, like Alfred Crosby has talked about Europeans settling all around the globe. But here in the case of Andaman Island, you would see that the Europeans, although attempted to settle there, but they failed. But then they brought in people from mainland India to settle there. Now, this also led to the displacement and mortality of the indigenous communities. So there are, you know, multiple ways to understand this hypothesis of ecological imperialism, right? When we take up the case of eucalyptus plantation in the context of ecological imperialism, what I mean is that how its introduction, especially in countries like India, led to gradual widespread cultivation of this eucalyptus tree, and which was actually not native, and it had a significant ecological impact. Eucalyptus was basically a native plant of Australia. So they were extensively planted in various parts of the world later on, but originally it belonged to Australia. So large-scale cultivation with eucalyptus in various non-native regions has been criticized by many historians for its potential negative, you know, ecological consequences. And in fact, this aligns with the concept of ecological imperialism. That's why, although as I said that Alfred Crosby doesn't at all talk about eucalyptus as one of the plants which had implications in different parts of the world. So few of the key points which are essential for us to understand while we discuss eucalyptus plants or plantations in India, or its transfer from Australia to India. One of the important aspect would be, you know, the biological displacement. So when we talk about eucalyptus plantation, you know, particularly when eucalyptus was replacing many of the indigenous plants, gradually what we see is that in those particular regions where eucalyptus was introduced, it established some kind of a monoculture of eucalyptus. And in fact, there was gradually a complete displacement of the native plant species. And obviously, one of the ecological implications is that it reduces the biodiversity, right? So, but you know, there are many other problems with this kind of a displacement by foreign plant. So the dominance of eucalyptus tree negatively affected the landscapes, the original food sources of those native lands. And then, you know, there are also recent studies which suggest that the eucalyptus plantation leads to reduction in the water table. In fact, there is a very interesting story about Delhi University. When I was a student here and living in a hostel, there was one hostel which had lot of water retention, because the water table in that area was being very close to the ridge. The water table was at a higher level, and the buildings, just because these were British time buildings, the walls of those rooms used to suck water from the ground, and there was seepage all around. So Delhi University then came up with a solution by planting eucalyptus trees all around the walls of that hostel rooms, so that the water table goes down. And that was very I don't know, but today I can see that this was not a very sound idea, because that's something which is, water table, obviously it will suck water. This is what the eucalyptus plants are known as. But then it would not be enough until you create a jungle of huge plantation of the eucalyptus tree around. This is just an anecdote to make you understand that, what could be the, implication of a eucalyptus tree if it is done in a large scale manner. On water resources, of course, you also have the implication. Even today, many believe that it also has the fire risk, as you know, that in Australia, countries like Australia, you have often the fires taking place. So many believe that eucalyptus trees contain some kind of a flammable oil. Many of the medicines are made with the eucalyptus tree. So these are very highly combustible. And so in regions with a history of wildfires, you would find that there is a presence of eucalyptus tree in large numbers. Now, this is in general the implication, but let us talk about specifically the works of historians who have worked on this transfer of eucalyptus from Australia to India and many other South Asian regions. The eucalyptus, in fact, was a drought. It was considered to be a drought-resistant crop, and it was normally thriving in Australia in the dry region. So, in 19th century, or among the 19th century botanists, the eucalyptus was considered to be a plant with a miraculous characteristics. Now, in the 19th century, eucalyptus was also considered to be a plant with a lot of health benefits. So this had actually led to its popularity among the many bureaucrats who were working for the British government, who were involved in some kind of town planning. One of the historians who has worked on this is James Petty. He is a historian, environmental historian from New Zealand. James Petty, in fact, has written a beautiful book called Empire and Environmental Anxiety. So in there is one section, in fact, on eucalyptus, wherein he mentions about the introduction of eucalyptus in India, although he does not talk about the eucalyptus transfer in detail. But at one point he mentions that that the initial large scale attempt to cultivate eucalyptus in India was basically around the hill station. And then he also mentions that he found one of the documents which suggests that Tipu Sultan may have been the first person to have brought the specimen of this eucalyptus to India. Right, so he might be having some kind, Tipu Sultan might be having potentially as a, it is possible that he was having some kind of a broad tree planting program, which for some reason could not be successful. His plans could not be implemented. But then he said that he had brought the one of the specimens. He had asked people to bring that specimen from Australia. Now, obviously, later on, what we see that in the 19th century, many hill stations were having eucalyptus plants, and eucalyptus was introduced by the British in the hill stations because they thought that it had multiple advantages in the hill stations. They thought that it was just because it was growing very fastly, and so it could have, it served as a protective layer of greenery to the hilly regions where they had their summer times. So it provided them also with a lot of fuel wood. And they thought in the 19th century that it had a positive impact on the soil as well as on the climate. Later on, we see that it was introduced also in the Nilgiri Hills. In Ooty, if you go in Ooty, you will find a lot of eucalyptus plant. In Kannur district, in Mysore, Coorg region, all these areas. In fact, if you go to Uttarakhand, mein jayenge aap to Rani Khet wala ilaka pura bhara hua hai. So, eucalyptus was introduced in this 19th century with the belief that it has health benefits and it provides greenery. And just because it could grow very fast, they thought that it is a good idea to plant those trees. And it goes very straight up in the sky, so it would provide some kind of a, protection from the sun also. Now, in 19th century, another theory which might have influenced the transfer of eucalyptus to India was the miasma theory. They thought, the scientists at that of the British government thought that many of the illness which the Europeans suffered in India was because of the bad air. So the British foresters at that time, the botanists of the time, they came up with the idea that eucalyptus can be a game changer, because they thought that it has a positive impact on the air, and this could help them to counter many diseases, especially diseases like malaria. So the promotion of eucalyptus as a disease fighting plants also gained popularity among the official circle, and they had already experimented this in southern Europe. They had experimented this in many other parts of North America. So they realized that the plant was very successful, and this could provide them health benefits here in India also. So James Beattie wrote an article specially on this plant transfer, I will be sharing that article with you, The Imperial Landscape of Health. in which he talks about the plants and the people between, the transfer of plants and people between India and Australia. So in that article, he mentions about the how eucalyptus was introduced in the marshy plains of India due to, you know, its moisture absorbing property. And he explains that how it was believed during those days by the botanists of the time that the plant had the ability to, you know, convert the, you know, disease-ridden kind of a soil or muddy areas into healthy environment. Right. So, in fact, he mentions that how many British experts propagated this theory of, you know, good health benefits related to eucalyptus plantation. Obviously, as I mentioned, that miasma theory was one of the theories which was being discussed during those years. And the Europeans would, I mean, they were always looking for some kind of a solution to, I mean, solution to such diseases which were there in South Asian regions. Now, in fact, one of the analysis says that when the 1857 revolt happened, the British actually had realized that their dietary and lifestyle changes alone were not sufficient enough to survive in the Indian climate. And that's after the revolt, the colonial experts, the scientists, they argued that, there was a revolt against the British because they had become weak. And, not only weak, but they were also dying because of different diseases. And it is essential for the government now to come up with solutions. So they, different experiments that were done in Australia, in New Zealand, in Africa, they were all pooled together, and then they were these knowledge were then used in India. Now, one of the knowledge that had influenced the eucalyptus transfer was the knowledge of eucalyptus and the success of eucalyptus in the Tasmanian island. Now, Tasmania was praised for, because when the Europeans settled, they said they realized that there, despite the absence of marshes, or, despite having such a harsh climate, the death and mortality of the British were not so high. So they thought that possibly the region was the presence of eucalyptus in that area. And this was one of the influences that that influenced the British scientists to come up with this idea of bringing in eucalyptus to India. So for many of the British residents, hill stations became very crucial, as you know. So, hill stations were crucial for them, for not only for their health benefit, not only to protect themselves from the summer, but also for the security reasons, right? Now, that's why, you have Ooty, Darjeeling, Shimla, which emerged as important centers. Now, eucalyptus was introduced in all these hilly areas. And this was to maintain the healthiness. And it played a very significant role in the settlement of the British. When they were settling, they wanted some kind of a picturesque green environment, and the eucalyptus plant provided that. Now, away from James Betty's interpretation, a completely different interpretation has given by another historian, who is Brett Bennett. Brett Bennett is he wrote another piece which is titled as "The El Dorado of Forestry: The Eucalyptus in India." So he talks about the eucalyptus transfer not only in India but also in South Africa and Thailand. Now Bennett presents a completely different perspective on eucalyptus. Now, although he acknowledges that initially the eucalyptus was introduced because of its health benefits, but his emphasis is that why eucalyptus became so very popular in later years was because of the economic reasons. So Bennett says that the plantation of eucalyptus trees had actually led to the changes in the local ecologies, no doubt. It in fact facilitated a shift towards some kind of a market-based capitalism, we may say. So it benefited the British, the people who had settled there, because it provided them a lot of wood. So he says that there was a lot of emphasis on growing eucalyptus because it was giving them economic benefit also, and in fact it gained popularity not only in India but also in South Africa, in Malaysia, because of the same region, right? So he talks about these different regions and he finds that all these regions were having these eucalyptus plants. There were a lot of plantation done in these areas because British colonial government was finding it economically very beneficial. So he says that it is after 1850 you will find that foresters established extensive eucalyptus plantation in the Nilgiri Hills, right? And in fact later on, even the independent government of India came up with the state sponsored promotion of eucalyptus plantation. So even after 1950s, the trend continued of eucalyptus plantation. So, I mean, these are the two different kinds of analysis that has been provided by the historians, environmental historians. Now, when it comes to the case of ecological imperialism, In isolated islands such as Andaman, where I said that it was very challenging region, attempts were made by the British to settle there because it was a strategic location. I mentioned in my earlier class that this was a location which was in the middle of the Indian Ocean, and this could have provided flagpole zone for the British. Now, environmental historians have in the past shed light on historical interaction between various indigenous communities of such isolated islands. In fact, in the case of Andaman Island, there is a very important, significant work of Vishwajit Pandya, who examines the life of the Andamanese people and they explores the relationship of the British and the convicts with these Andamanese. Later on, there were very interesting works like that of works like that of Satadru Sen, who has talked about the medical hegemony of the Andaman in the Andaman island when the penal colonies were established after 1857 revolt. Aparna Vadik has also written on the early historical developments, especially post 1857 revolt penal settlement. And in fact, if you read Aparna Vadik, she in fact the title of her book itself is Imperial Andaman, and she places the history of Andaman within some kind of a broader context of imperial politics in the Indian Ocean. And so her emphasis is on the penal colony, and she says that it stems out especially in the context of 1857 revolt. So her an emphasis is on 1857 revolt, and then the development of a penal colony in Andaman Island was the result of the 1857 revolt. So that way it is a very interesting work. Now, in fact, I wrote 2-3 years ago about a different perspective on the Andaman Island. In fact, I was influenced a bit by the hypothesis of ecological imperialism, and then try to see if some kind of biological transfer, or the implication of biological transfer, or human transfer, the influence of that human transfer could be observed in this landscape. Now, when I examined the course of colonial developments in the Andaman, I saw that there was, there were early attempts by the East India Company to establish some kind of a, not exactly a flag post, but they wanted to take control of this area in 1780s. Now, the most of the mainstream work would say that, the penal settlement was established in the Andaman Island in post 1857 period. But I could see that there are few documents in the archive which would suggest that the earliest attempt was made in the 1780s. It was long before the need for the remote penal settlement, for political prisoners, which is the emphasis of most of the works. Now, the documents from 18th century also indicate that the intention to establish a penal settlement, which was in fact similar to the Botany Bay settlement in Australia. So this was actually the early stages of British interest in the Indian Ocean. So they were finding places such as Botany Bay, Andaman, various other, in places like Thailand, all these areas, to establish, their flag posts, to have their influence and control over the Indian Ocean. Now, one of the often cited reason for the British takeover of Andaman is the Denmark's control of the Nicobar Island. So Nicobar jo tha wo us samay late 18th century mein, it was controlled by Danes. So geopolitical strategy was in fact one of the reasons why the British were ambitious to take control of the Andaman Islands, which was still that time not controlled by anyone. सो निकोबार आइलैंड जो थोड़ा सा दूर है, हालांकि आज हम लोग उसको पार्ट ऑफ इंडिया कहते हैं, अंडमान एंड निकोबार एक ही तरीके से नाम लेते हैं क्योंकि एक ही रीजन में है, बट निकोबार थोड़ा हट के है। सो निकोबार वॉज कंट्रोल्ड बाई डेनमार्क एंड अंडमान वॉज कंट्रोल्ड बाई देन अटेम्प्टेड टू बी कंट्रोल्ड बाई ब्रिटिश। तो मेरा जो एम्फेसिस था, माई एम्फेसिस वॉज ऑन यू नो टू अंडरस्टैंड दिस सेटलमेंट इन टू डिस्टिंक्ट फेजेस। एक कि 1789 से 96 के बीच में क्या अटेम्प्ट जो हुआ, क्योंकि अल्टीमेटली देर वॉज एन अटेम्प्ट मेड फॉर दीज 5-6 ईयर्स एंड देन आफ्टर मेनी ईयर्स, आई मीन देर वॉज अ कंप्लीट गैप ऑफ ऑलमोस्ट 50 ईयर्स एंड देर वॉज नो अटेम्प्ट मेड एंड देन आफ्टर 15 ईयर्स अगेन देर वॉज एन अटेम्प्ट मेड। सो बाई using the proxy records along with many archival sources, I have tried to understand the different dynamics of British control at that time. So my first phase talks about the first phase attempt, why it failed, right? The second phase shows that the evidence of environmental anxiety, how it influenced the British policy in the Indian Ocean during the later part also. So the environmental anxiety that I talk about is the frequent shipwrecks that are taking place. So there are various shipwrecks that have been taking place, which were, and the ships at that time were considered to be very costly, and they, you know, actually, I mean, the British were very concerned about, you know, controlling these shipwrecks. As I mentioned that the second part of my whole hypothesis, in fact, I published this 2-3 years ago, but then the second part is still in work in progress, which has gone for publication some in one of the journals. But the second part of my hypothesis about the implication of this environmental anxiety is the whole issue of the development of meteorological science in the Indian Ocean region. So that part I have discussed in that article, which will be published in few months time. Now migration and the mobility also played a very significant role, and I have discussed about that, and I mentioned that how, you know, the British failed here. You know, in the first phase, they failed because there were many mortalities, many deaths. So the climate was such harsh that the British officers, the soldiers, they were not able to survive in that environment. So they decided to, you know, even though they had controlled that region for 5 years, they decided to go away because there were many deaths taking place due to diseases of the Europeans themselves. Now, here is a second attempt. Now, in the second attempt, the strategy has changed completely. Now, they have brought in Indian political prisoners, which is happening later on, but earlier it is the hardcore prisoners who were brought here to work as laborers, as convict laborers, right? And it has actually gradually changed the Andaman demography, because now through this transfer, through this migration of the people from the mainland India, the disease also traveled. Various diseases traveled, and it infected the indigenous communities of the Andaman. So it's not that the Europeans only are the carriers of the diseases. It is also the mainland Indians who are the carriers of diseases, because these are isolated people living in the Andaman Island. So they brought the labor to clear the forest. They brought the labor to clear the, to use these lands for agricultural cultivation. And this led to rapid transformation of Andaman landscape and also of the demography. So the experience, and I have used as a source the experiences of various early convicts also. So one of the books that I'm writing, still writing, is about one of the experience based on experiences of the convict. Now, the history of the Andaman Island during that age of empire, obviously, then my emphasis is on the geopolitical and environmental factors. What you could see if you read my article, I will be sharing that with you, that contrary to Alfred Crosby's notion or understanding of Western European colonial introduction, because if you read Alfred Crosby, he would always say that the Europeans have been able to invade the region or conquer those regions with their biological allies, right? Now, here is a region where the British had come, but it is not their allies, but the, allies from the mainland India. So the crops have been brought from India. The agricultural techniques have been brought from India. The animals have been brought from India. So, for example, many goats, cattle, they were brought from Indian mainland. So, if you try to understand my poor story of Andaman Island, it is slightly different from what Alfred Crosby is talking about. But then it is influenced, I must acknowledge, that it is influenced by Alfred Crosby's hypothesis of ecological imperialism, right? So the policy as such, which the British followed, had a significant impact on the natural environment of the Andaman Island. But then it also had a profound demographic shift. So Andamanese ka population kam hota chala gaya. और जो मेनलैंड इंडिया से लोग आए थे या थाईलैंड से लाए जाते थे कॉन्विक्ट लेबर के रूप में, उनका पॉपुलेशन बढ़ता चला गया. सो व्हाइल द इंडिजिनस पॉपुलेशन, द नंबर ऑफ पीपल बिलोंगिंग टू द इंडिजिनस कम्युनिटीज, द अंडमानीज, दे देयर नंबर डिक्लाइन, बट द नंबर ऑफ साउथ एशियन कॉन्विक्स एंड देयर फैमिलीज इंक्रीज्ड. सो The British presence on the Andaman island, actually, it was characterized by anxiety, disease, disaster, changes in the landscape. But then it showcases a unique quality of ecological imperialism, right? But then obviously it is different from the neo-European kind of imperialism. Right, so we could have different sorts of implications of European or ecological imperialism in different regions. That's the main thrust of my argument. I told you, in fact, about an anecdote of a native who was carried to Calcutta and paraded before the Governor General there. So, I mean, these are different stories that you find in many archival documents and which I've used in my story.